KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump's global tariff plan kicks in, with tariffs on China set to rise to at least 104%. How soon will the stuff you buy get a lot more expensive? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. A federal judge orders the White House to restore the Associated Press's access to presidential events. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. We'll hear about the state of the free press in the U.S. and the threats to existing libel laws. Also, you probably have AI in your smartphone, but how useful would it be to have AI in your fridge or stove? And the president is scheduled to get a physical this week. It's Wednesday, April 9th. Happy birthday to former Morning Edition host David Greene. He turns 49 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Stocks open higher this morning as President Trump's new tariffs take effect. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 300 points in early trading.
Double-digit tariffs on goods from dozens of countries kicked in overnight. U.S. importers are now paying 20% more on most things they buy from Europe, 24% more on imports from Japan, and the tax on goods from China now totals more than 100%. China punched back, announcing an extra 50% tariff of its own on U.S. exports. That takes effect tomorrow. The escalating trade war has sparked fears of a worldwide economic slowdown, pushing the price of crude oil to a four-year low. Investors are also dumping U.S. treasuries. That's caused a sharp jump in U.S. borrowing costs, which will likely make mortgage rates here even less affordable. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Meanwhile, member states of the European Union have also decided to impose retaliatory tariffs on some $20 billion in U.S. goods. These levies are in response to the 25% tariffs that President Trump imposed earlier on steel and aluminum imports. These EU tariffs will come into effect next Tuesday. European officials have cautioned they would prefer to negotiate with the Trump administration. The U.S. Supreme Court is allowing the mass firings of thousands of probationary federal workers to stand, at least for now. It's the latest decision in an ongoing legal battle over the Trump administration's efforts to slash the size of the federal government. NPR's Kristen Wright has more.
In a brief order, the justices found that nonprofit groups bringing the legal challenge against the government don't have standing to sue over the firings of 16,000 probationary workers. The nonprofits and labor unions argue the Office of Personnel Management didn't have the authority to order the firings and didn't give employees adequate notice. The high court's decision blocks a California federal judge's order to reinstate the workers, but didn't reach the question of whether the firings were lawful as the case moves through the lower courts. Kristen Wright, NPR News, Washington.
Education Secretary Linda McMahon spoke at an education technology conference yesterday in San Diego. She's defending cuts to her agency. As NPR's Janaki Mehta reports, the Trump administration has often said education should be determined by the states.
What is taught in classrooms already is up to states, and 90% of school funding comes from state and local sources. But the federal government helps oversee laws and ensures funding goes where it's needed. With the U.S. Department of Education already cut in half, McMahon was asked what would happen to schools without that kind of federal oversight.
Some states will do better than others, and that's a fact.
So McMahon asked private sector donors, including those sitting in the room, to start doing their part to help fund education. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR. Rescue teams in the Dominican Republic are continuing to dig through the wreckage of a collapsed nightclub. At least 113 people were killed Monday night when the roof caved in Santo Domingo. Some of the victims include popular merengue singer Ruby Perez. He died along with a local Dominican governor and two former Major League Baseball players. The Keystone Oil Pipeline is still shut down in North Dakota. There was an unexplained rupture yesterday. NPR's Giles Snyder reports the federal agency that oversees the nation's pipeline system is sending a team to investigate the cause of the break.
The Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration is responsible for millions of miles of oil and gas pipelines like Keystone. It's sending investigators to look into what happened near Fort Ransom, North Dakota. Officials say an employee heard a mechanical bang and shut down the pipeline within a couple of minutes. The company that operates Keystone estimates that about 3,500 barrels of oil spilled into an agricultural field in a rural area. The industry watchdog group Pipeline Safety Trust says the safety agency is under-resourced and underfunded, and several media reports say it has lost several key leaders, including the top pipeline safety official, to buyout offers from Elon Musk's Doge cost-cutting team. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
The measles outbreak is spreading in Texas. There are more than 500 cases now reported. Several have surfaced in new counties. That includes among several children who attend a daycare center in Lubbock, Texas. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Total Wine & More. For discovering something new, like a Cabernet or single-barrel bourbon, learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. The U.S. has hit one of its largest trading partners with steep new levies in an escalation of its trade war. The import tax on Chinese goods is now at least 104%. Most Asian markets fell as the latest round of President Trump's tariffs took effect just after midnight.
And China has swiftly retaliated by increasing its levies on U.S. goods to 84%, up from 34%. The European Union, meanwhile, approved its first set of retaliatory tariffs. The bloc plans to impose duties of 25% on a range of U.S. imports starting next week. U.S. markets are swinging between small gains and losses in early trading. We're going to go now, though, to NPR international correspondent John Ruich in Beijing. So, John, what more can you share about Beijing's reaction?
Yeah, Beijing really came out swinging today once again, as it had promised. As you say, you know, China announced that it was adding a 50% tariff on top of its other tariffs on U.S. imports, matching Trump's latest two escalations step for step. This takes the base tariff rate on U.S. imports into China up to 84%. Now, that's different than the base U.S. rate on Chinese imports to the U.S., which is 104%, and that's because Trump imposed 20% tariffs earlier in the year and China responded differently. Since then, though, it's taken the gloves off. Here's Foreign Ministry spokesman Lin Jian speaking through an interpreter earlier today.
We will not let anyone take away the Chinese people's legitimate right to development. We will not tolerate any attempt to harm China's sovereignty, security, and development interests. We will continue to take resolute and strong measures to safeguard our legitimate rights and interests.
So in addition to the tariffs that were announced today, Beijing once again blacklisted a handful of U.S. companies, putting them on export control lists or unreliable entity lists.
Yeah, other countries are choosing to negotiate or offer concessions. Why is China taking this path?
Well, China's casting this whole thing in kind of stark black and white terms. It's essentially right versus wrong. Beijing projects itself as a champion of free and fair trade now and of multilateralism, and it accuses the U.S. of engaging in selfish and irresponsible protectionism, even blackmail in this case. President Trump said yesterday China wants to make a deal and he's waiting for them to call. Well, China's leadership has also flagged that it's willing to negotiate, but not under duress. The foreign ministry spokesman Lin Jian said the U.S. must adopt an attitude of equality, mutual benefit, and respect. I mean, ultimately, I think the Chinese leadership believes that China can tough it out and that in the long run, this trade war is going to damage the U.S. more than China. It's worth noting, of course, that China isn't the only country taking the path of retaliation. The European Union is planning to put sanctions on a range of U.S. goods, from steel to non-alcoholic beer.
You said China believes it can tough it out, but with tariffs in these ranges, these numbers, I mean, it's going to be painful.
Yes, there absolutely will be pain from these tariffs and from the retaliation, and that actually sort of the point, according to Guo Shan, who is a partner at the Beijing-based research firm Hutong Research. She says tariffs are basically so high now that meaningful negotiations are impossible until one side or the other cries uncle and caves.
It's a strategy, escalate to de-escalate.
Escalate to de-escalate is what's happening. She says Beijing has been preparing for this since the first trade war back in 2018, and the leadership's confident. You know, China's been doubling down on policies to strengthen its self-sufficiency. Policymakers feel like they have a lot of ammunition for economic stimulus if they should need it. The currency's been allowed to weaken. The government's been propping up share prices, et cetera, et cetera. So China's been expanding its trade also with diplomatic relations with other countries.
What other reactions have we seen outside of China?
Well, Asian stocks fell sharply today. Some governments in the region are trying to position their economies to cushion the blow. India, for instance, cut benchmark interest rates today. Governments haven't said a whole lot. They're working quietly, trying to negotiate to get these tariffs lowered or dropped.
That's NPR's John Ruich in Beijing. John, thanks.
You bet.
For more about what's next on tariffs, we've got Mary Lovely on the line with us. She's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and her expertise is tariff policy as it relates to the U.S. and China. Good morning, Mary. Thank you for being on the program.
Good morning, Layla.
So we see these incredibly steep tariffs on Chinese goods, expectations that China will retaliate as intensely, both countries talking tough with no one backing down. Where does this go?
Well, it looks like we're headed to a stalemate. The Trump administration has been talking very tough on tariffs and especially on China. And while we know the Chinese have been in Washington looking for ways to begin negotiations, none right now are forthcoming.
Now, if you could just put these tariffs into context for us, how do they compare to the ones President Trump issued in his first administration and President Biden kept in place?
Yeah, there are very big differences between now and what happened in 2018, 2019. Many look at those and say, well, that wasn't so bad. This time is different. First of all, the tariffs are on all products. There's no carve-outs that would cushion the blow for American companies or American consumers, big ones being Apple. Secondly, they're on not just China, but on all countries. So the first time we had a trade war with China, companies were able to go around China, perhaps moving to subcontractors in Mexico or Vietnam. Now we're seeing tariff rates on some countries as high as almost 50%. And lastly, just the height of these rates are really very high, and U.S. importers are going to have trouble dealing with them and passing them forward or even absorbing them into their profit.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think a lot of people are just concerned about what it means for their pocketbook, how much they will be able to afford. I mean, how much can companies actually absorb until they pass those costs on to consumers?
Well, it really depends on the company and how much market power it has. The first time we had a trade war with China, we saw that 100% of that tariff burden was borne by the American importer, whether that was a firm or a consumer. About 25% overall of it went actually into the you saw at the cash register. This time we expect it to be different. The rates are so high, especially small and medium businesses are having trouble already. Lots of reports of suppliers, particularly in the auto parts sector, having trouble posting bonds because the companies have to post bonds ahead of time for the amount of tariff that they might be on the hook for once those imports actually clear the port. So they're having trouble. Some companies announcing they may help their subcontractors. All in all, we're expecting to see some business failures. There are many small businesses that import things that they use to produce here and are simply saying they cannot bear this burden.
Where do you think the biggest increase in prices will be seen?
Well, I think you'll see it most clearly in consumer goods. These were largely spared, not entirely spared in the first trade war, but we're going to see it quickly in electronics, in home goods, in clothing and apparel, lots of things that people buy very often. Companies, of course, will see it in all kinds of inputs and commodities that they buy from abroad. There will be some carve-outs. Some of the types of things like semiconductors that the administration has spared are actually have their own tariffs. We're going to see, or we expect to see, more tariffs coming from the Trump administration, like we've already seen on the automobile sector.
Now, what do you think about the negotiations? Do you think this will likely change things?
I think smaller countries for whom trade is very important, particularly those who trade with the U.S. is very important, such as Vietnam, will certainly be eager to cut a deal. China, whole different story. We've already heard from the reporter that that's unlikely to happen.
Mary Lovely is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Her expertise is tariff policy as it relates to the U.S. and China. Thank you, Mary, for your time and your insights.
You're welcome.
Manufacturers are rushing to put artificial intelligence and other smart features into their home appliances. Sometimes, though, it's not clear how useful it is. Here's NPR's James Dubek.
Samsung has a new vacuum with an unexpected feature. It can alert you to incoming calls and texts. The company's new washer and dryer can also make phone calls. The appliances are part of a new AI product line, and Samsung isn't alone. LG, GE, and others are also pushing AI in their home devices. But do consumers want AI in a vacuum cleaner? Online reviews have been skeptical, suggesting the features aren't worth the premium price, and only 15% of households own a smart large appliance. Some experts say companies are just throwing out ideas to see what works.
The industry looks at these new features. They're, in a lot of cases, they're testing out the new use cases. So seeing what might stick in the years to come, what customers might be interested in.
That's Rick Kowalski, an industry analyst with the trade group, the Consumer Technology Association. Some of these AI features could be useful, like a fridge that gives you recipe recommendations based on what's inside. And from the manufacturer's standpoint, they want data. If you connect an appliance to the internet, then the manufacturer could track how it's used over time. Samsung did not immediately respond to NPR's request for comment. Elizabeth Parks is a market researcher who works with some appliance companies. She says connected devices help create an ongoing customer relationship.
It creates a service model, right? You sell the large appliance, the refrigerator, or the washer dryer, and then maybe you sell the maintenance that goes with it, and there's your service plan.
There's a long way to go before most people own a smart refrigerator or washer. Parks' surveys found customers don't see a lot of value in smart features when they add on costs. Customers also have security and privacy concerns. Stacy Higginbotham, a policy fellow at Consumer Reports, thinks more transparency is needed there. She says at some point, your home's smart devices stop getting software updates from manufacturers.
When they stop providing security updates, I'm going to have a vulnerable device on my network, so I will need to take it offline.
Experts say most appliances' core function should remain even if the device is offline. Still, Higginbotham says that when it comes to AI and smart appliances,
manufacturers talk a pretty good game about this, but the features they deliver are not really there yet.
James Dubek, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, how can one man disrupt the global economy? We talk about Trump's tariffs, why they've led stock markets to plummet, how they're changing our relationship with allies and adversaries, and what tariffs mean for our daily lives. We talk with Zanny Minton Beddoes, editor-in-chief of The Economist. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. In partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. President Trump is scheduled to get his annual physical exam at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center on Friday. At 78 years old, Trump is the oldest president to start his second term. He follows former President Biden, who visibly slowed down while in office. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith reports.
When he first ran for office in 2015, then-candidate Trump's doctor put out a statement that described his lab results as astonishingly excellent and concluded he would be the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency. The doctor later said Trump had dictated it to him. Then came Dr. Ronnie Jackson.
Some people have, just great genes. I told the president that if he had a healthier diet over the last 20 years, he might live to be 200 years old. I don't know.
Trump is known for his love of McDonald's and isn't a fan of exercise. Jackson was Trump's first White House physician. In January 2018, he held court in the briefing room, answering questions at length about the president's health, including his cognitive health.
I was not going to do a cognitive exam. I had no intention of doing one. The reason that we did the cognitive assessment is plain and simple because the president asked me to do it.
Jackson said Trump scored a 30 out of 30. Years later, in a Fox News interview, Trump described the test.
Like you'll go person, woman, man, camera, TV.
It's a very basic assessment that includes remembering a short series of unrelated words.
Person, woman, man, camera, TV. They say, that's amazing. How did you do that? I do it because I have, like, a good memory, because I'm cognitively there.
Since the end of his first term, Trump has released very little health information, just a 2023 doctor's letter without any data, saying he'd lost weight and, quote, his cognitive exams were exceptional. Last year, President Biden's doctors chose not to give him a cognitive exam, something Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre was forced to defend repeatedly.
The president himself, he said it today, he said it multiple times, and the doctor has said this. Everything that he does day in and day out as it relates to delivering for the American people is a cognitive test.
Even after Biden dropped out of the race, Trump leaned in on cognitive testing as a campaign issue.
We should have cognitive tests for anybody that runs for president and vice president.
Trump has been known to jumble words and, during the campaign, wobbled like he might fall when getting into a garbage truck. And he is acutely aware that some have raised questions about his fitness. Take this from a rally in October.
I'll be at a little thing and I'll say something a little bit like the. I'll say duh. They'll say he's cognitively impaired. No, I'll let you know when I will be. I will be someday. We all will be someday, but I'll be the first to let you know.
S.J. Olshansky is a professor of public health at the University of Illinois at Chicago, who has studied the health of presidents. He says there are many armchair neurologists, but a president's doctor is the only one who truly has all the necessary context.
But keep in mind, medical records are private. Presidents do not have to reveal their medical records.
And in fact, there is a long history of presidents concealing their health challenges. Jeff Coleman was a physician in the Clinton, Bush, and Obama White Houses. He points to what happened when President Woodrow Wilson had a stroke.
His second wife and his physician, a young Navy doctor, they covered up for him for several months, and they were not truthful with the American people.
Coleman says there's no requirement for a presidential physical, but the public and media expect them now.
To me, the purpose of the physical for the president is to give him honest feedback about here's how your heart's doing, here's how your brain function's doing.
Whether that honest feedback is also shared with the public is another question entirely. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
This morning, the Library of Congress announced 25 new additions to the National Recording Registry, including this album by Sir Elton John. So goodbye, yellow brick road, in the dark clouds of society how. Songs, soundtracks, sports broadcasts, and more will be added to the hundreds of recordings the library is preserving for posterity. NPR's Netta Ulaby has more.
The recordings added to the registry this year range from a 1973 Ranchera classic by Vicente Fernandez to a 1960 World Series radio broadcast.
Here's a swing and a long drive to deep left center.
To the gentle ambient soundtrack to the video game Minecraft, released in 2011. In 2000, Congress passed the National Recording Preservation Act. The registry that resulted protects and reflects American history and culture through recordings. Usually it adds a few recent hits that generate publicity, but one of the oldest recordings added this year is a version of Sweet Georgia Brown from 1949.
Hey man, who's that cat coming down the street?
I don't know, but it sounds to me like that whistling man with the bones.
Freeman, sure, Brother Bones Davis, was born in Alabama in 1902 and moved to Long Beach, California. He was so talented at whistling and clacking animal bones together, customers flocked to the shoeshine stand where he worked. Eventually, Davis made this surprise hit with a small record label. It's still the theme song for the Harlem Globetrotters. The newest addition to the National Recording Registry is the 2015 cast album of the musical Hamilton.
The musical's creator, Lin-Manuel Miranda, described the registry in an interview with the Library of Congress.
It's a artistic version of a nation's conversation with itself.
The recordings in the registry are timeless, he said, and all are products of their time.
And so to listen to these recordings, to go back as far as the turn of the century, to the beginning of recorded sound, to the present, is to hear points in a timeline, is to time travel.
And what an honor, he said, for this recording of Hamilton to now be a point on that timeline. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the hit medical drama The Pitt, actress Taylor Dearden is being celebrated for her portrayal of a talented young emergency room doctor who, like Dearden, is neurodivergent.
Recognizing that something's hard for anyone and then being able to overcome it if you are neurodivergent, like, hopefully that should just make it even sweeter.
I'm Elsa Chang. How The Pitt portrays neurodivergence and gets it right. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump's sweeping tariffs on dozens of countries took effect today. It prompted a swift response from China and countries in the European Union. Beijing added another 50% tariff to U.S. imports, raising China's total tariffs on American goods to 84%. The EU says it's placing retaliatory tariffs on billions of dollars worth of U.S. imports. They include orange juice, soybeans, and motorcycles. NPR's Anthony Kuhn says the expanding trade war sent stocks in Asia lower today.
South Korea's KOSPI index sank to its lowest closing in 17 months, while its currency, the won, plunged to its lowest level against the dollar in 16 years. The government pledged more than $10 billion in financing to the nation's auto industry this year to cushion the blow of 25% U.S. tariffs. Japan's Nikkei stock index, meanwhile, ended the day down nearly 4%, but Japan's currency ended higher as investors bought the yen as a safe haven asset. The White House has indicated it'll prioritize tariff negotiations with South Korea and Japan and seek bigger payments from those allies for the cost of stationing U.S. troops in their countries. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
U.S. tariffs on imports from China total 104%. This is NPR News. A new Trump administration policy designed to curb Social Security fraud is being criticized by the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Here's NPR's Ashley Lopez.
Starting on Monday, people seeking retirement or survivor benefits from the Social Security Administration will no longer be able to apply over the phone. Instead, they will have to seek services online or in person at a local Social Security office. Officials say this is an effort to prevent fraud, but Kathleen Romig with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says this is a hurdle for Americans without internet access. Plus, she says, about 6 million seniors live more than 45 minutes away from the closest office.
That's really burdensome for a lot of people. Not everyone drives, particularly seniors or people with disabilities. Not everyone is able to leave the house. Think about people who are homebound or hospitalized.
Romig says ongoing staff cuts at the agency will likely increase wait times for in-person services. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
South Carolina is preparing to execute its second death row inmate by firing squad in little more than a month. Officials say a red bullseye will be placed on the chest of the inmate at a prison in Columbia on Friday before three volunteers fire live ammunition. The 41-year-old prisoner was convicted of killing an off-duty Orangeburg police officer. He chose a firing squad over lethal injection or electrocution. I'm Dave Mattingly.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez.
I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. This week on Morning Edition, we're exploring the state of free speech in the United States. For some Americans, that's almost synonymous with the right to a free press, but not for others. In recent years, President Trump has called for nearly every major American TV news network to be punished in reaction to interview questions or coverage he dislikes.
Because they are crooked, they're dishonest, and frankly, they should have their licenses or whatever they have taken away.
He's filed lawsuits against CBS and the New York Times and banned organizations like the Associated Press from the White House press pool for not following his order to rename the Gulf of Mexico. But the president isn't the only one seeking to use the courts to punish unflattering news coverage. Local officials and business moguls are also turning to lawsuits or the threat of them, with varying degrees of success. To talk more about this, we called New York Times editor David Enrich. He is the author of a new book titled Murder the Truth, Fear, the First Amendment, and a Secret Campaign to Protect the Powerful. David Enrich, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First, would you just set the table for us and tell us about the case of the New York Times versus Sullivan? That's a Supreme Court case at the heart of the book, as briefly as you can.
This is a case that the Supreme Court decided in 1964. The idea was that if you want to have a free press and if you want to have free speech, it's really important to make sure that people are not afraid that if they screw up a fact or make an honest mistake when they're writing or speaking about someone powerful, that they're going to subject themselves to kind of limitless liability. And so the Supreme Court created a standard called the actual malice standard, which essentially means that if you are a public official or a public figure, in order to win a lawsuit, you need to not only prove that someone defamed you, so injured your reputation with falsehoods, but also that they did it either knowing that the facts were wrong, so lying, or basically acted with reckless disregard for the truth. So this was a very high bar that the Supreme Court created for people to make sure that they could speak freely and criticize freely powerful people in the country or in their communities.
There has been, in recent decades, the rise of a conservative media ecosystem, right, which amplifies, you know, the views of the conservative movement and also, obviously, President Trump's views. They also position themselves in opposition to other legacy media organizations and portray themselves as being more fair, more accurate, et cetera, et cetera. So that's not a secret. Your book talks about a secret campaign to protect the powerful. What is that?
Well, there's been a legal movement underway in this country now for 10 or 15 years to curtail the protections that journalists and members of the public have when it comes to speaking out or speaking about powerful people in their communities or the country. It has been increasingly effective at making the argument that the media no longer deserves the First Amendment protections that it has long had. And the argument is predicated on this idea that it has become impossible for normal people, when their reputations are damaged by the media, to seek recourse through the courts. And of course, that is a sympathetic argument. It's just not the case. It's not true, though. And there have been many examples recently of powerful public figures and public institutions managing to clear the high bar that the Sullivan case set and still win in court. And one of the things I saw through my reporting for this book was that all over the country, there have been hundreds of examples in recent years where powerful people, whether it is a mayor or a police chief or a local business owner, all the way up to the president of the United States, are using either the threats of legal action or lawsuits to muzzle people or to at least intimidate them. The fact is, even when those cases get thrown out of court, it basically leads people to self-censor.
Give an example from the book, if you would. A smaller news outlet, for example, being sued over its reporting.
Yeah, and it doesn't even take an actual lawsuit for this to work. And one of my favorite examples in the book involves a newspaper in Colorado that had a reporter who was writing about a local real estate development. There were some environmental and safety concerns, and the local real estate development company hired some very powerful local lawyers to represent them. And they then proceeded to send a bunch of threatening letters to the journalist and his bosses and the publisher. And very quickly, the newspaper started getting cold feet and stories were either watered down or spiked. And the newspaper stopped covering, at least in a negative way, this real estate development.
So what I think I hear you saying is that these tactics aren't being used to achieve redress when something is wrong. You're saying they're being used to curtail reporting when the facts are actually right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's just a huge power imbalance in a lot of these situations where a local business or a wealthy individual who has, for all intents and purposes, unlimited resources to just drag this out through the court system, send a million threatening letters, and grind someone down through the legal process. And it comes at a time when most news organizations and most journalists are operating kind of on a financial knife's edge. And lawyers and law firms recognize that the simplest, safest thing for most journalists to do is often to back down.
You know, one of the things that's been really interesting about the current environment is there are a number of news organizations have settled lawsuits that a lot of First Amendment observers thought they could win. What has changed that it makes sense for these news organizations, if indeed it does, for them to settle these cases when people say you could win those?
Well, I think one of the things that's changed just in the past few months is that we have a president who has shown himself very willing to use the powers of the presidency and the federal government to pursue vengeance against his enemies. And so the one that settled was ABC News, which had been sued for defamation because its anchor, George Stephanopoulos, got some facts wrong in a segment about Donald Trump. And as you said, most First Amendment experts thought that if that went to trial, ABC would prevail. Instead, they settled by agreeing to pay $16 million to Trump and his presidential library. The rationale is that big businesses are afraid that if they don't make peace with the president is going to do things that really severely damage their businesses. And that's not an argument necessarily in favor of capitulating. But this isn't just about kind of the law and the Constitution at this point. This is also about trying to understand the possibility that Trump might try to seek extra legal retribution.
That's David Enrich, Deputy Investigations Editor with the New York Times. David Enrich, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yesterday, a federal judge ordered the White House to restore the Associated Press access to cover presidential events. The judge found the government had violated the news organization's First Amendment right. Tomorrow on the State of the First Amendment, the right from which all rights flow, a new online portal lets students and parents report on teachers who give diversity, equity, and inclusion lessons in class, and that has some teachers worried. A far-right advocacy group says it's about stopping discrimination. Is rooting out DEI in schools silencing some teachers? This is NPR News.
We'll have the latest market and diplomatic fallout as President Trump's sweeping tariffs on countries around the globe take effect. That's next time, here and now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, Amy Martinez. When you look up at the night sky this weekend, you might catch the moon playing it cool. It's what astronomers call a micromoon, when the full moon is at its farthest point from the Earth, making it look smaller and dimmer. Now, the change is subtle, but if the skies are clear, most of North America, Europe, and parts of Asia and Africa will have a perfect view. Think of it as the moon giving you some space, as opposed to that super moon that's all up in your face. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Painter Amy Sherald has a retrospective opening today at New York's Whitney Museum of American Art. In 2018, she painted Michelle Obama's portrait seated in a flowy white poplin dress, resting her chin on her hand. NPR's Olivia Hampton met Sherald at the Whitney and brings us this report.
The show is called American Sublime. For Amy Sherald, who came up with the title, it links back to her family roots in the South.
When I think of American Sublime, I think about my mother, who was born in Mobile, Alabama in 1935, and what she survived to become and live in the year 2025. So the beauty and the terror of what it was to be raised in the South.
Sherald paints black subjects using shades of gray for their skin tones, and it contrasts with her otherwise striking color palette. It lets viewers consider the subject's humanity before their race.
I think subconsciously I had a fear about my work solely being about identity and race, and I didn't want that. I think that was one of the important things that I thought about. It's like this work has to speak to not only people that look like me, but also sit in the world for all of us to understand.
Sherald is subverting traditional narratives of who is American. There's a black couple standing proud in front of their car and yellow house, a transgender Statue of Liberty with bright pink hair, a brawny boxer without legs in a ring. The portraits look out at the viewer. They seem to have a rich interior life. Rujeko Hockley curated the Whitney's iteration of this traveling exhibit after its first stop in San Francisco.
It's really about kind of individuality, interiority, how we adorn ourselves, how we move through the world, and the kind of idiosyncrasies of everybody in the world.
Hockley points to a 10-foot canvas where two black men restaged the iconic World War II photo of a white male sailor kissing a white nurse in Times Square. In Sherald's portrait, the men are both sailors kissing against a blue sky.
It's a very kind of quietly subversive but very impactful act to reimagine this image that people really have burned into their minds. This kiss is kind of one of the most iconic and well-known photographs of the 20th century, and just this tweak transforms it entirely.
Today, Sherald's bright, bold portraits are owned by collectors like CNN's Anderson Cooper or sportscaster Brian Gumbel. But her journey was a long one.
I was waking up and going to my studio at 8 o'clock in the morning and working until 3 p.m. and leaving my studio and then going to wait tables from 3 to 12. I was broke for a very long time, but I always believed in myself and believed in the work and knew I had something special. And so I always tell young artists, the world is full of quitters, so don't quit and you'll eventually rise to the top. And here I am, ta-da.
Sherald's breakthrough didn't come until she was 45 when she painted Michelle Obama. That work was commissioned by the National Portrait Gallery, which is set to host a show in September. But it's part of the Smithsonian Institution, which President Trump has targeted in an executive order for being, quote, under the influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology.
We're talking about erasure every day, and so now I feel like every portrait that I make is a counter-terrorist attack. It's to counter some kind of attack on American history and on Black American history and on Black Americans.
The show is at the Whitney through August 10th. Olivia Hampton, NPR News, New York.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
The new Trump tariffs are now in force. China then raised the ante, and the EU says it'll do tariffs next week.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bank of America. Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And by Commvault. When companies face ransomware and outages, they can recover data and business in just minutes with Commvault.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. China has responded to President Trump's import penalties by raising its tariffs on U.S. exports again, this time by another 84% starting tomorrow. China's foreign ministry says negotiations are still possible. Marketplace's China correspondent Jennifer Pack is in Shanghai.
China says the U.S. tariffs are a bullying tactic. Previously, Chinese leaders retaliated on certain American exports that hurt President Trump's electoral base, like agricultural goods. But now Chinese officials are countering U.S. tariffs. Here's the tally so far. If you add all previous rounds of U.S. tariffs on Chinese exports under Trump's second term, they total over 100% versus 84% on all American exports to China. And these figures are on top of existing levies. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pack for Marketplace.
And the European Union said today it has 25% tariffs on the way on a subset of U.S. goods. The BBC's Elizabeth Hodson reports.
The new tariffs that the EU has announced will affect $22 billion worth of goods from the US. It's believed they'll be brought in three phases, with the first set coming into effect on Tuesday next week on around $4.3 billion worth of stuff the US sells to EU countries. A month later, on the 15th of May, another $15 billion worth of goods will be impacted, followed by a further $3.8 billion from the 1st of December. These tariffs are in response to the 25% import taxes President Trump imposed on all steel and aluminium, and which came into force in mid-March. The EU isn't able to move as quickly as the US on trade policy because all 27 member states need to vote on any new tariffs. However, in its statement announcing the tariffs, the EU did make clear that these countermeasures can be suspended at any time should the US agree to a fair and balanced negotiated outcome. In London, I'm the BBC's Elizabeth Hodson for Marketplace.
The news agency Reuters has seen a document indicating U.S. corn will be one target for EU tariffs next week. The CEO of the biggest bank, Chase's Jamie Dimon, told Fox Business today a recession is a, quote, likely outcome of the tariff war, when that's the view people sell bonds. And that has the 10-year interest rate up sharply at 4.35%. The Dow just turned down 260 points now, 0.7%. S&P had been up, now down 0.5%. The Nasdaq's earlier big rise has mostly fizzled. It's still up 0.4%. President Trump was on social media today telling Americans to be cool, and that investors that this is, quote, a great time to buy.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Affinity, provider of the CRM for the private capital relationship economy. Affinity knows who has the best relationship with the right startup. Affinity.co/marketplace. And by Sold a Story, investigating how the education system got reading wrong and takes you places getting it right. Sold a Story, available in podcast apps.
These remain deeply divided times, and the workplace is no escape. Our series turns today to Colin Woodard, historian and director of the Nationhood Lab at the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University in Rhode Island. His lab has done surveys that identify some widely shared principles Americans generally agree on. Mr. Woodard, welcome.
Thank you very much.
What were you and your team hunting for?
Well, we were hunting for what is it that Americans might still have in common? Why should the red states and blue states stay together? Is there something that we still share as Americans, you know, that's our common umbrella? And that came very quickly to the question of, well, what's America for? What's our purpose? You know, where did the country come from? Where is it going? Who belongs? All these questions that scholars would say is the national narrative of a country, something every country needs, and our country has had a very contested one, and we wanted to work out if there's still a shared narrative or a latent shared narrative out there that can be a common story that can hold us all together.
So you asked people, you tested ideas with people. How did you come up with what we're about to hear?
Well, I'd done work as a historian on the national story. Like, ours had been contested from the beginning, right? We had a bunch of colonies that didn't see eye to eye, that fought in the 1770s against consolidation of British power and found themselves in something called the United States together. It was kind of by accident, but nobody knew what that was. And so there had been this struggle from the very beginning to define what's the United States, what's a United Statesian supposed to be? And that quickly became a battle between defining our country in terms of devotion to a set of ideals, or one that, no, this is the ethno-state or ethno-states of a particular people. And that battle between an ethno-national and inherently authoritarian vision and a liberal democratic one, small l, small d, has been at the core of our story. And is that civic national story that we're devoted to a set of ideals and decoration, what does that look like? Do people still believe that now? And how would you talk about that now? So we did exactly what you suggest. We went out and did polling. And what we discovered almost immediately is the answer is yes. Large majorities of Americans across race and gender and political party and region and education levels do in fact prefer and believe in that narrative tied to the ideals in the Declaration.
All right. So hit me with something that will bridge the I'm talking to a Fox News fan or an MSNBC fan gap.
Our purpose as a country is to realize those sets of rights in the Declaration, that each person was given to them by the universe or God or nature's God, the right to survive, to live safe in your own person, free from domination, to live the life you choose for yourself, and to take part in determining who represents us and holding them accountable. And that we as Americans are in like an agreement, a covenant even, to defend one another's rights to these things. That's it. That's the American promise, like this pledge to uphold these inalienable shared rights. And the American experiment is the effort to try to actually build a nation or a society where that's possible.
One of Colin Woodard's books is American Nations, a history of the 11 rival regional cultures of North America. But he's also director of the Nationhood Lab at the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Put in the words office politics at Marketplace Online for more ways to deal with hard political divisions on the job. I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.